serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I know this has not been a typical episode, but I sure am thankful for the privilege of sharing some time with Ed and Dorothy Krominga and examining the POW experience through multiple lenses today. If you caught the beginning of today's program, you heard me mention that this weekend marks the 10th anniversary of the first episode of Hometown Heroes. Intended at the time to complement a series of television features I'd been airing for a while, the reality as we approach our 500th episode of this show is that a large portion of the veterans who've shared their stories here are no longer with us. But the guest on episode numero uno is still going strong now at the age of 94. I had the privilege of visiting with Augie Macaluso and his lovely wife Ida again this week, 10 years after we first met. I've shared a fresh picture of the couple for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And if you want to hear that entire original episode, you can pull it up on hometownheroesradio.com. But here's some of the story. We're going to pick it up with Augie, a 20-year-old infantryman from Pennsylvania, arriving in Europe in late 1944 with the 106th Infantry Division.
We relieved the 2nd Infantry Division, the 23rd Regiment, and they had moved all the way up to the Siegfried Line, but then had to pull back because of the lack of supplies. But they had dug in pretty heavily, and they had good fortifications that we assumed. As they left, they said, "You lucky guys, you're in a quiet zone. You really have it made." Well, that didn't last very long. Exactly 5:30 in the morning, December 16th, the German artillery opened up with a barrage that lasted for nearly an hour. If you would liken yourself to being in an aluminum or a metal shed and had somebody throwing gravel at you, that's what it sounded like when we were in this earthen bunker. There were our shells all around the area. Fortunately, there were no direct hits. We knew something was going to happen, but we had no idea it was going to be as massive as it was.
You did all right the first day, surprised as you were, but it wasn't long before you ran into something that you weren't exactly prepared for, at least that you had no chance to fight against. Tell me about that.
That's true. The outfit to the left of us was overrun, and we in turn were overrun by the Germans. And directly in front of us was a minefield, heavily mined. It had been mined by the Germans when they withdrew. It was mined by the 2nd Infantry Division when they were there, and we were there long enough to put some mines out. So you didn't dare go out into that territory unless you had a guide who knew exactly where the mines were. So when the Germans came in and captured us, they told us that by putting Schmeisser machine pistols to our head, that we had to move across that minefield. Well, we were reluctant, but when you're looking at a Schmeisser machine pistol, you decide that you'd better go. We had to go over a double-apron barbed-wired fence. It was shaped like the letter A, with strands of barbed wire on each side. You had to pick your way over. As a result, I was the last one in the group, and I was the last one with a German right next to me. There were artillery shells coming in at that time because we had asked for close fire. These were American artillery shells. And the German who was right next to me was as frightened as I was. He ran up a number of yards in front of me, and when he did that, I moved off to the left as fast as I could and made a headlong dive into a snowbank.
Knowing full well that when you try something like that, they're liable to turn one of those Schmeissers on you and let loose, right?
Yes, I felt that could happen at any second.
But it didn't.
Fortunately, no. And it was almost twilight, almost dusk at that time. And when I went in, I just didn't move. I stayed in position for endless amount of time. After about 3 or 4 hours, I looked around to pull my head out of the helmet because my helmet had frozen in the snow. I pulled my head back and tried to locate where I was, but I couldn't get any direction at all. Finally, German artillery illuminated some of the buildings in the little village that we had been protecting, and I knew now what direction to go. My fists, which were underneath me, were now frozen solid, so the only way I could find my way out was to put my fists into the footprints that I had made as I dove into that area. As I did that, my right hand hit something metallic, and I realized it was probably a mine called a Bouncing Betty or a Bouncing Betsy.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me another half hour to move after that because I was really frightened when I realized I only missed that by a number of inches.
Now, you knew which direction you were heading in, but did you know who had control of that area where you were headed?
I did not know at that particular time. The only thing I did know that about 50 yards on each side of me, I could hear Germans talking. So I'm now in the German lines. And before I made this burst to go across there, the American artillery started a fire in that area. So I had gone through a German artillery fire a couple of days before, and now I am enduring an American artillery fire. And their bits of shrapnel were coming right over me, and you could hear them just twisting and turning and singing as they, and they would land in the snow. It really frightened me. When I hit that double apron barbed wire fence, running up to it, I felt as though I was running on my knees because my legs were so frozen. I hit that double barbed wire fence and flipped over and then began to run, expecting any minute to have bullets hitting me in the back because the Germans weren't that far from me. Apparently, they were as surprised as I was to be out there. As I got closer to the position that we had held before I was captured, I heard somebody say, "Halt."
Uh-oh.
Halt is the same in German as it is in English, but this one had a little bit of a southern tinge to it, and I knew it had to be Captain Comer, my captain from Alabama. It was, and I was home safe, at least for a while.
Prayers answered, at least for now.
Yes. I reported to him what had happened. I told him about the position of the Germans, where they were firing, when they were firing. I told him what happened to our squad, that all of them had been captured, including myself, but I was the only one who got away. That included my squad leader, both and my assistant squad leader. The assistant squad leader was wounded at the particular time when we were captured from those artillery shells that came in. I learned later that he died in a prisoner of war camp. But my sergeant, Sergeant Roberts, is alive. He survived, and I'm still in contact with him these many years later.
I want to talk about Sergeant Roberts. The day that the attack started, December 16th, he had a little problem with his wristwatch?
Yes, his GI watch malfunctioned. And he said to me, "Mac," he referred to me as Mac, "would you mind letting me have your wristwatch?" And I was reluctant to do it because this had been a Christmas gift, an early Christmas gift to me, given to me by parents before we left to come overseas. And I said, "Yes, I'll give it to you, but whatever you do, please return it." Well, he was taken prisoner, and he was in prison until late May of 1945. He could have sold or given it away, sold it, whatever. He could have bribed the Germans with it. He could have had food, whatever he needed, if he would give up that watch. But he did not.
But you didn't get it back. And years passed. And I want to bring in another guest. A little bit of a surprise for you here, Augie, someone who knows the story that we're talking about. We have Stuart Stern with us from Seattle, Washington. Stuart is an Academy Award nominated screenwriter, won an Emmy Award for his work. But back in 1944, he was in Europe, too, with the 106th. And Stuart, I understand that in 1977, you arranged a meeting between Augie and Sergeant Roberts.
I guess I did. It's hard to remember back that far. I remember the bulge better than 1977. Hi, Augie.
Hi, Stuart. This is a surprise. A real surprise. So good to hear you.
And maybe not as big a surprise as what happened at that dinner in 1977. Augie, tell us what you experienced while you were waiting for dessert.
Well, we were waiting for dessert. Sergeant Roberts leaned over to me and he said, "Augie, I have something I want to give to you that I promised I would return." And at that moment, he gave me the watch. 33 years later, I had my watch back.
And it still works?
It still works. It's kept in a safe deposit box at the bank, but one of our children will get it eventually, I'm sure.
Stuart, I want to ask you, as the witness to that reunion of Augie and his watch, which obviously there are a few more things more important to him than his watch, but a pretty special moment for him at that point. Do you recall his reaction, the expression on his face, what that moment was like to be sitting there with him?
Well, it was a mixed moment. He was thrilled to get the watch, but not entirely thrilled about where it had been. Because Sergeant Roberts, when he was captured by the Germans, knew that he had his honor pledged on protecting that watch. And the big question was where would he be able to hide it? And he finally, literally, found a place on his anatomy where that watch would be safe and where nobody could possibly have found it. And I don't think I'll go into details, but that watch has been to places that most of us have never been. And still, when he handed it to Augie was just thrilled to death. The battle was so extreme that it took, you didn't care how extreme you had to be to protect the things that you cared about, because the smallest thing became, especially if it was lent to you by a friend, the most important thing in the world.
Isn't that eloquently put? What else would you expect from a writer as gifted as Stuart Stern, responsible for the James Dean hit Rebel Without a Cause, among others? Stuart Stern passed away in 2015, but the friend he surprised by phoning in on the very first edition of Hometown Heroes 10 years ago is still going strong at 94. What a joy it was to reconnect with Augie Macaluso this week. That original episode has more from Augie, more from Stuart Stern. And not only do I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, we also have the television story that accompanied it. So that watch, that priceless memento that carried so much symbolic value, you can see that watch along with Augie's smiling face when he shared his story on TV 10 years ago, while also giving us a debut radio episode that foreshadowed so many of the elements that have been so compelling in story after story. The close call, the horror of being captured, in his case, the thrill of surviving a daring escape, and the one that's always most powerful for me to hear, that unshakable bond that develops among men who put themselves on the line for each other. So thanks to Augie Macaluso. Thanks again to Ed and Dorothy Krominga today. And thank you for listening to the first 10 years of Hometown Heroes. Lord willing, the next 10 will be just as meaningful. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free.